become my amusement and never cease to be novel. It was a drama of many scenes and without an end. Henry David Thoreau. Everyone likes the results of a good house cleaning. Though most of us aren't excited by the idea of cleaning house, there's probably not a single person who doesn't like the results of a good cleaning. Would anyone look at a room that's been thoroughly cleaned and curse? I don't think so. A spotless room is a welcoming sight for anyone. Back when I was surrounded by stuff, I used to hate cleaning. No matter how often I cleaned, dust would keep accumulating. I also hated doing the dishes. I'd look at them all piled up in my kitchen sink and promise myself that I would get to them tomorrow. Then I'd head straight to bed. I hated this never-ending cycle of housework. Unsurprisingly, my home was always a mess. There even came a time when all the floor space was filled with books, and I recall thinking that at least I would no longer need to clean the place. Near my old apartment, there was a ginkgo tree that loomed over the sidewalk. Each morning, I would see my middle-aged neighbor busy sweeping away the fallen leaves, and wonder how she could stand doing that day after day. The leaves were falling all the time anyway, so why didn't she just take care of the sweeping once a week, or even every other day? That had been the old me. Now I can understand how the woman must have felt. It wasn't the fallen leaves that she had been tidying up. It was her own laziness that she had been sweeping away. There's no such thing as a lazy personality. I used to think of myself as a lazy person with no willpower. I believed it was a personality trait that couldn't be changed. Besides, I would tell myself, how unusual was it for a guy to be a slob anyway? But all that has now changed. Each morning I vacuum my apartment before heading off to work. I tidy up the bathroom whenever I take a shower, and as a result it's always squeaky clean and shining. I do the dishes as soon as I finish eating. I do the laundry before my dirty clothes form a huge pile, and hang dry the washed items on my balcony, where I also wipe everything down, including my neighbor's balcony. Yet I haven't gone through a personality change. So why am I no longer a lazy slob? The simple reason for the clean new me is that I now have fewer possessions, and it's simply easier to clean house. I don't have a lazy personality now, and I didn't back then. Aristotle's method for cleaning up. Aristotle believed, as paraphrased by philosopher Will Durant, that we are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. You don't need a strong will to tidy up regularly and maintain a clean home. Determination alone will eventually fade anyway. All you need to do is make household cleanup a daily habit. Once it becomes a habit, you'll be able to clean up without a second thought. The rewards for making cleanup a habit. It's said that getting a reward is key to developing a new habit. With daily cleaning, the reward may be the sense of accomplishment and calmness we feel afterward. There's also the reward of the self-confidence we gain when we've overcome all those excuses for not tidying up. As minimalists, cleaning becomes easy and quick, yet we still get rewarded all the same. We actually start to enjoy cleaning as a result, and it naturally becomes a habit. Same goes for all the other chores that need to be done at home. To develop a cleaning habit, the important thing is to make it easy to get those rewards. It'll be a snap if you have fewer possessions. Cleaning becomes three times easier when you have less. When I had been living in my old apartment, I might have vacuumed once in a good month. Even after I had minimized quite a bit, I still only cleaned my apartment on the weekends. But now I vacuum my new apartment every morning. It became a habit simply because it's so easy. Cleaning can be really easy if you have fewer things. Let's look at how we might clean the floor if we had an owl sculpture in the room. Step 1. Move the owl over. Step 2. Wipe the floor where the owl had been sitting. Step 3. Return the owl to its original position. And if we didn't have this statue in our home? Step 1. Wipe the floor. There. Done. It's that simple. It takes a third of the effort, and probably a third of the time, to clean the floor. And forget about wiping those intricate hollows and crevices in the sculpture itself. Now imagine the work we'd have to do if we owned 3 or 4, or maybe 10 or 20 of these sculptures at home. Without clutter, your possessions have a natural resting place. Now that I've discovered the comfort of living in a place that isn't cluttered with objects, I've become quick to put things away. I put my hairdryer away as soon as I finish using it. There had once been a time when I couldn't believe when Marie Kondo said she only pulls out her remote control for the TV when she wants to use it. But I'm finding now that I'm doing the same thing. It's really no trouble at all. Once it becomes a habit, it's a natural flow to bring something out, use it, and then put it away again. Remember when you first learned to ride a bicycle? I'm sure you must have been very careful to maintain your balance as you pedaled. But the skill is soon acquired, and before you know it, you're riding without a second thought. It's the same way when I clean house. I don't really think about it. It's as if my possessions return to their rightful positions on their own. The joys of living in a small apartment. This spring, I moved from a 25-square-meter, about 300 square feet, home to a smaller place that's 20 square meters in size. What this means is that I now have 5 square meters less space that needs to be cleaned. House cleaning is easier than ever, not to mention quicker. My feeling now is that I would like to live in as small a place as possible. Even my current apartment was a bit too spacious for me at first. The cleaning work is simple, fun, and it feels good. I doubt I'll ever buy a robot vacuum cleaner or have someone else do the cleaning for me when it can be such an enjoyable task. And in my small apartment, with my few cherished possessions, cleaning really becomes an intimate act as well. Dust and grime are reflections of our past selves. It is often said that cleaning your house is like polishing yourself. I think that this is a golden rule. It isn't just dust and dirt that accumulate in our homes. It's also the shadows of our past selves that let that dust and dirt continue to build. Cleaning the grime is certainly unpleasant, but more than that, it's the need to face our own past deeds that makes it so tough. But when we have fewer material possessions and cleaning becomes an easy habit, the shadows we now face will be of our daily accomplishments. Getting up early in the morning, taking a refreshing shower, sitting down to a leisurely breakfast, cleaning and doing the laundry before you leave for work will definitely affect the way you get on at the office. Simply by living an organized life, you'll be more invigorated, more confident, and like yourself better compared with when you used to stay in bed until the last minute and rush through everything just to get to work. And when you like yourself, it'll be easier to take on other challenges. People can change, starting with their lifestyles. The pressure to build a successful future. You're important and you're irreplaceable. Be yourself and be unique. Go for it. Strive to achieve something. We know everyone means well, but young people are probably bombarded with these types of messages on a daily basis. They're constantly being pressured to become someone. I, too, had been under the same kind of pressure, and I was frustrated by my inability to fulfill these expectations. Having parted with most of my belongings, one thing that I can honestly say now is that there isn't really a need to accomplish something or build an ambitious future. We can begin to be content with ourselves and feel plenty of happiness by simply going about our daily lives, appreciating the present moment. When I finish my simple cleaning tasks in my new apartment and take a stroll around the neighborhood, I realize there isn't anything more that I need or want. I go to the park and watch the ducks in the pond as they fluff their feathers. I see how relaxed they look, when all they're doing is fluffing their feathers. They aren't filled with tension trying to become something else. They aren't frantically attempting to build their careers, and they aren't sucking up to the other ducks. All they seem to be doing is enjoying the water, fluffing their feathers, and living their lives. When it comes right down to it, isn't that all we really need in our lives, too? Having parted with the bulk of my belongings, I feel true contentment with my day-to-day life. The very act of living brings me joy. I have more freedom. It's only after we've lost everything that we're free to do anything. Tyler Durden, Fight Club. The freedom to move. Isn't it true that birds are free to soar high into the sky because their nests are simple and they aren't weighed down by the need to accumulate things? I used to be the complete opposite of those birds. I had a huge shelving unit taking up space in the kitchen, and at one point I even had a darkroom set up in one corner of my place. In the hallway stood massive bookshelves holding tons of books. I used to think back then that for my next move, I would need lots of space and storage for all these things, and probably even a whole extra room where my huge TV set and home theater setup could be fully enjoyed. I would look for available apartments on the web, but could never find such a place within my budget. And besides, it was going to be a pain in the neck packing up all those things and then unpacking them again at my new place. After going minimalist, I moved for the first time in a decade. It was from Nakimiguro to an area called Fudomai, not too far away. And the packing, without a single cardboard box, mind you, the move itself, and unpacking all took but an hour and a half. I kid you not. The next time I move, I'd like to find an even smaller place to live. The 20-square-meter apartment where I now live seems to be too large for me. It would be lovely to live in a place of about 12 square meters, about 130 square feet, like author Dominique Leroux. Plus, with smaller apartments comes lower rent. I've finally been freed from all my old search criteria, a need for so much space to store this item or that, and a living room that has to be so many square meters big to put everything in it. It takes so little time to move to a new place. I've parted with my possessions and gained the freedom to move whenever the mood strikes. The freedom to choose a new lifestyle. Many people are now exploring various new types of housing. Some examples are author Tomoya Takamura's hut that he built for $1,000, Kiyohei Sakaguchi's mobile house, and of course, the tiny house movement. These initiatives are all creative alternatives to the conventional 30-year mortgage. The number of vacant houses in Japan is expected by some accounts to reach 40% by the year 2040. Plus, with Japan's frequent earthquakes, the risks of living in a conventional home continue to increase each year. All these new lifestyle options have one thing in common. They are not normal, large houses where many things can be stored. It's easy for a minimalist who has few possessions to choose any type of home they desire. And I find all these new lifestyle options fascinating. I imagine the trend will continue to gain momentum. Lower living costs lead to a freer life. There's an important concept called minimum living costs that refers to the minimum amount of money you need to live. I think it's worthwhile for everyone to calculate this for themselves at least once, by adding up rent, groceries, utilities, communication charges, and so on. I live in a place called Fudomai in Tokyo, and my monthly rent is 67,000 yen, about $650. I can live happily on 100,000 yen, about $1,000 a month, and that includes other modern necessities like my iPhone. I'm perfectly happy cooking all my meals, doing my reading at the library, and taking walks in the park to relax. It's all possible, even enjoyable, because when you take up minimalism, you really do stop comparing yourself with others. And once you let go of the needless pride that triggers thoughts like, I'm not someone who should be doing this kind of work, or I'd like to live in a home like they featured in that magazine, or I don't want people to think I'm poor, there are plenty of jobs out there that'll pay 100,000 yen a month. As a result, I don't even have to worry about retirement anymore. I'm optimistic, knowing that all I have to do is earn 100,000 yen each month. Many jobs are available today where all you need is an online connection. So you can even live someplace abroad where minimum living costs are even lower. There's no point in putting up with a terrible job or working yourself to death just to maintain your standard of living. By having less and lowering your minimum living costs, you can go anywhere you want. Minimalism can really be liberating. Liberated from your personas. We all identify with our possessions to some extent. I considered my huge collection of books, CDs, and DVDs as a part of who I was. It's hard to part with something that you love, because it makes you feel as if you're throwing a part of yourself away, and I can certainly relate to that. But the truth is, by letting go of my books, CDs, and DVDs, I was able to achieve a fundamental sense of freedom that's hard to put into words. It's freedom from my personas, you could say. As a self-proclaimed connoisseur of film, I used to watch 5 or 6 movies a week. I would be embarrassed if there was a movie that everyone was talking about that I hadn't seen. I wanted to show off the fact that I saw so many movies. I wanted to be able to say, "That movie? Yeah, I saw it. I saw that other one, too. Yeah, I'd like to even see this other movie, too." Though I still remain a fan of movies, I realized that before, I was just attached to this persona of a film enthusiast. These days, I don't worry about how many movies I see. I'm no longer a film enthusiast, but someone instead who enjoys only the movies I really need to see. Now, when an unfamiliar film title comes up in conversation, I have no qualms about asking, "What's that? Tell me about it." There are things you love so much that they start to feel like they're a part of you. They assemble themselves into a persona that you then have to maintain. Parting with those things means you're freeing yourself from that particular consciousness. Liberated from greed. When you become a minimalist, you free yourself from all the materialist messages that surround us. All the creative marketing and annoying advertisements no longer have an effect on you. Celebrities no longer make you feel envious. Fancy window displays, reward cards, spiffy new high-spec products, new high-rise condos under construction. None of it has anything to do with you, and you can stroll around town feeling comfortable and free. As I explained in Chapter 2, the more things you have, the more you accumulate. You'll never be satisfied when trapped in this cycle. It will only make you want more and more. It's like a monster that becomes hungrier and hungrier as it eats. Witiko is a Native American word, literally translated as man-eater, which refers to a mental disorder in which you want more than you need. This disorder destroys people's lives. Left to its own devices, our hunger for things can grow out of control and become a monster. In the past, I was overwhelmed by greed. I was always looking for more. But now I have everything I need. There's nothing in particular I really want. It may come as a surprise, but it's really a fantastic feeling. I no longer compare myself with others. When you realize there is nothing lacking, the whole world belongs to you. Lao Tzu. How to become instantly unhappy. Want to know how to make yourself instantly unhappy? Compare yourself with someone else. I once watched a girl I used to love marry a guy who made a lot of money. I compared myself with him and felt miserable, blaming my income for losing her. But thinking about it now, money wasn't what I was lacking. When you compare yourself with successful people your age, you can't help but feel foolish and incompetent. Social media can seem full of people who are enjoying their life more than you. You can be walking down the street, see a group of strangers having fun, and immediately feel lonely. We always think the grass is greener next door, but the grass itself doesn't care. It's the person who owns that grass who's concerned about it. Sometimes we even use chemicals to dye the grass green so it matches the neighbor's lawn. But at some point, that grass is going to turn brown, its natural beauty destroyed because of needless comparison. Who does Bill Gates compare himself with? We can't help comparing ourselves with others. The problem is that there's no end to these comparisons. Let's say there's a guy who works at a tech startup. He'll see a very skilled senior member of the company and compare himself with her. In turn, that woman might be comparing herself with the CEO who started the company, while the CEO may be comparing himself with another CEO of a bigger, more successful company, and that CEO will be comparing herself with Bill Gates. So who does Bill Gates compare himself with? Maybe it's a younger version of himself, or a soon-to-be famous young entrepreneur. Once you start comparing yourself with others, you're always going to find someone who's better than you. No matter how rich you might be, how handsome, or how beautiful, there's always going to be another person who's richer or more beautiful. Even if you became a member of a big pop group in Japan, you might still feel miserable when you compare yourself with Johnny Depp or Brad Pitt. Or maybe you've realized your childhood dream of becoming a soccer player. You're still unhappy because you keep comparing yourself with Lionel Messi. Even if you rise to the top in a certain field, you'll always find ways to compare yourself with people in other fields. Now that I have parted with my possessions, I no longer compare myself with anyone. I used to be embarrassed whenever I compared my miserable apartment with someone else's home, or I would see an acquaintance buying everything they wanted and feel envious. But now I've been able to say goodbye to that old me, because I've stopped taking part in that rat race of never-ending comparison and accumulation. Experiences resist comparison. As I explained in Chapter 2, people get used to objects, and it's known that happiness continues for longer periods if it's based on experiences rather than objects. $1,000 coat will lose its novelty as you continue to wear it. But if you had spent the money on a trip with a friend, you can relive that joy every time you remember that trip, and the joy doesn't fade when you revisit it. So why do we tend to spend money on things instead of experiences? It goes back to our need to compare ourselves with others. Psychologist Sonia Lubomirsky points out that it's easy to compare your handbag with other people's handbags, since the price tag makes the value of a bag obvious. If it's a designer bag, then it's even easier to compare, because everyone is immediately aware of its value. On the other hand, a considerable amount of imagination is necessary if you want to compare your yoga class to someone else's game of golf, or your fishing trip to another person's camping expedition. Perhaps that's why experiences give you longer periods of happiness. You'll feel a much richer sense of contentment by building your experiences rather than buying items, because your experiences resist comparison with others. And because they are tough to compare, your experiences don't even have to be anything rare or expensive to be special to you. When you stop comparing, you find yourself. Just like our accumulation of material objects, once we start comparing ourselves with others, it will be endless. In the process of writing this book, I would never have been able to write a single word if I had started thinking about books that have been written by people who are better than I am. Let's face it, there will always be people who are better than we are. If we start comparing ourselves with those people, agonizing over how we think we're nothing compared with them, we'll be completely paralyzed. But when you say goodbye to all your unnecessary things, you also say goodbye to the process of comparing yourself with other people. After all, you no longer have any of those material objects that are used to compare your status with others. And once you are a minimalist who only has what you need, your focus will inevitably shift from others to yourself. Freed from comparing, you'll start to discover who you truly are. I stop worrying about how others see me. You're the only one who's worried about your face. Ichiro Kishimi and Fumitake Koga. Kirawareru Yuki. Courage to be disliked. Steve Jobs didn't get nervous. In the process of minimizing, I went through my clothes and minimized my wardrobe as well. As I explained in Chapter 3, it's possible to create more time and focus on the important things if we consider personal uniforms. Steve Jobs had his black turtleneck, and Mark Zuckerberg has his gray t-shirt. They agreed that it's a waste of time selecting which clothes you want to wear. They would rather spend that time doing something creative. There's another benefit to a minimalist wardrobe. Because we choose items that are timeless, we don't need to worry about being out of style. We don't wear eccentric styles, so there's no need to be concerned about whether an outfit really suits us, if it's the right combination, or how others might judge us. We don't envy expensive clothes, and we aren't embarrassed about wearing cheap clothes. In other words, we stop worrying about how other people see us. It's easy to be a little nervous when you walk into a stylish store, but take a minute to think about Steve Jobs, the man who always sported the same outfit. Do you think he would have been nervous if he stepped inside a Comme des Garçons store, wondering what people would think about his outfit? I used to be overly self-conscious in the past. Just walking around town, I would wonder if people thought my outfit was embarrassing or didn't quite work. I think that by going minimalist in the clothes that I wear, I've become more relaxed about how others may see me. The real reason it's hard to dine alone at a restaurant. It's hard to dine alone at a restaurant. Take a Korean barbecue place, for example. Don't you get paranoid that the restaurant staff, as well as the other patrons, might be watching you thinking that you have some nerve to do a one-person barbecue as the meat sizzles on the grill in front of you? That you must be lonely eating by yourself? Well, even if they were, they're only thinking that for 10 seconds or so, 30 seconds tops. Yet because we are focused completely on ourselves when we're having a solitary barbecue, we tend to think that we're being watched like that during our entire dinner. But put yourself in the place of those around you, and you'll see that no one's all that interested in you. As I said earlier, you're the only one who's worried about you. I don't think it's possible to prove what others may be thinking. Say you approached another patron and said to him, "Hey, you were thinking how lonely I must be to be eating alone, weren't you?" Maybe he'd say no, either to be polite or because it's actually true. Maybe you'd follow up, saying you can prove it because he was staring and laughing at you until a minute ago. But you still won't be able to counter if he says he was just laughing about something else. Maybe he was in fact thinking about what a lonely diner you are. Maybe he wasn't. It's impossible to prove either way. It's useless being hung up over something that you can't prove. It's even more of a lost cause if you're unable to do as you like because you're worried about how others might see you. If you want to have a private barbecue dinner, well, why not just go for it? No one's as concerned about you as you may think. Everyone's busy and wrapped up with their own lives. Keeping up appearances only holds us back. There was a time when I wasn't quite comfortable with e-books. Print books are wonderful. It's quick and easy to turn the pages. They have that analog sense of warmth, and the intricate binding work is fun and easy on the eyes. I think the real reason why e-books gave me a sense of unease, though, was not because they lack the appeal of paper as much as the fact that they simply can't be stacked up after reading. I owned an enormous number of books that I had thought I liked and collected, only to realize that I just picked them up for the sake of appearance. I wanted people to see them and be impressed by what a person of depth I was and how thirsty I must have been for knowledge. It's clear now that I wanted to convey to others what a worthy person I was through my books. For that purpose, they absolutely had to be piled up in stacks as I finished reading them. Anyone who sees a pile of books will think that you've read a lot. I felt uneasy about e-books because it would only look like I'd read a single book, regardless of how many thousands of works I'd gone through. There were many books I had left sitting around unread for years. I had told myself I would read them one of these days. But I realized now that they were mainly there to keep up my appearance as an intellectual. Now that I've parted with those unread stacks, I've been able to concentrate on the one book that truly interests me at the moment. As a result, I'm reading more books. Parting with my old books has spurred my interest in new areas. By letting go of the old, I've been able to get hold of the new. Lessons from an unused camera collection. I like to take pictures. I also like to think I have pretty comprehensive knowledge about photography. There had been a time when I used my kitchen as a darkroom for color negatives. I collected beautiful antique cameras and visited auctions to buy one rare camera after another. I displayed them in my apartment, and I never once actually loaded them with film. I never used them. They were just a part of the decor. They were there so I could tell people I had a lot of cameras, so I could appear to be a camera enthusiast with an artistic streak. I've since sold all my cameras. I used an auctioning agent and parted with everything at once, including my moisture-proof storage cabinet. By going ahead and parting with all these things that I'd clung to for the sake of appearance, I began to worry less about how I looked in the eyes of others. I was able to let go of the useless pride and self-consciousness that plagued me like an extra layer of fat, preventing me from actually pursuing the things that mattered most to me. My apartment has reached a state where it's no problem to show any part of it to anyone at any time. The same goes for my backpack and my wallet. I'm no longer embarrassed about doing anything. From this point on, I'm simply going to do whatever I feel like doing. I'm more engaged with the world around me. Whatever you do will be insignificant, but it is very important that you do it. Attributed to Mahatma Gandhi. I'm no longer a super introvert. I now have time. I'm not afraid of how people see me. I easily keep up with housework, which leads to more confidence. This is how the positive cycle of minimalism begins, and what started as a tiny swirl will gradually become a bigger circle. Because of this cycle, there is no longer anything that prevents me from trying something. Here are just a few of the challenges I've tackled since becoming a minimalist that wouldn't have been possible for the old me. Tried scuba diving for the first time. I'd been thinking about taking it up for years. Made Zen meditation a regular habit. I nervously took part in a Zen session held by Ryunosuke Koiki. Participated in a yoga program at my gym. I used to think that people would laugh at how stiff my body was. Started contacting people I wanted to meet. People are willing to see me, even celebrities. Participated in face-to-face meetings with minimalists from all over Japan. These are always a lot of fun. Became friends with people I met through the internet. I now have friends I can go and see everywhere in the country. Started a website. I used to think that people who self-promote were too self-obsessed. Joined Twitter. I used to think that people who use Twitter were... well, it might be best to leave that out. Finally moved for the first time in a decade. It took 30 minutes, but it shouldn't take more than 20 minutes next time. Declared my love to a girl I thought was beyond my reach and started going out with her. The old me never would have had the guts to do this. Wrote a book, of course. The old me would have said, forget it. You're only going to embarrass yourself. The girl I began to date eventually dumped me, but I've been nursing my wounds by telling myself that it was because I still haven't fully grasped the true lessons of minimalism. I realize now I was always too busy worrying about how she would see me. Going forward, I'm going to focus on studying English. I'm also planning to enjoy the outdoors. I'd like to try my hand at surfing and maybe a little mountain climbing. And I've got my heart set on getting a motorcycle license as well. What's happened to the introvert that I used to be? Was I kidnapped by aliens? Did they plant a chip in me when I wasn't looking? Nothing that complicated or exciting, of course. All I did was say goodbye to my things. I'd rather regret something I've done than something I wish I had done. The regret we experience for not doing something leaves a much stronger impression on us than the regret we may have for doing something. In psychology, this is called the Zeigarnik effect, which says that people remember things that they once pursued and left incomplete more than they do the things that they had completed. For example, I'm sure most of us regret not telling someone we love them, and those feelings are likely to remain with us forever. Knowing that we were too scared to try leaves us with an even bigger regret than the fact that we didn't do it. The lesson is clear. If there's something you want to do, now's the time to do it, whether it ends in success or failure. That's why I wrote this book. I may regret it later, but I'm sure I would have regretted not doing it more. Overall, taking action leads to happiness. Minimalists can take risks. If you want to keep up the standard of living that you've built over the years and not let go of the items that you've accumulated, you have to preserve the status quo. And that means no changes and no risks. Whether or not you love your job, you have to keep it to maintain your quality of life and to hang on to all your possessions. It's often said that you have to endure your job to put food on the table or enjoy the nicer things in life. But wait, most of those nicer things and the money we need for them are just for show. We're driven by pride rather than need. Have less, be free, and you'll be able to go anywhere, whenever you want. You won't be worried about how others see you, so you'll be able to take on new challenges without being afraid of failure. Our minimum living costs will decrease when we part with our possessions, which means we'll have more freedom to choose our jobs. I used to be stuck, comparing the pros and cons of taking every action. I spent all my time looking for the most efficient and safest method to reach a goal, but I never did anything. Now I take action. I'm no longer worried about preserving some status quo. Seriously, minimalists have no possessions that they are scared to lose. That gives them the optimism and courage to take risks. Experiences can't be taken from you. Perhaps the most important reason for getting out there and engaging with the world is that the experiences you gain through your actions can never be taken away from you. Unlike our material possessions, our experiences are inside ourselves, and we can take them with us any place we go. No matter what may happen to us, the experiences are ours to keep. I can focus better. I can concentrate on being me. I'm as proud of what we don't do as I am of what we do. Steve Jobs. The Silent To-Do List. When we let go of our possessions, our ability to concentrate improves. Why might this be? Things don't just sit there. They send us silent messages. And the more the item has been neglected, the stronger its message will be. Maybe there's an English textbook that I gave up on before I even got halfway through it. It might be looking at me now and saying something like, "You look bored. Why don't you try to study me again?" Or there's a dead light bulb that has yet to be replaced. "Don't tell me you forgot to buy my replacement yet again. Why can't you do something so simple?" Or a stack of dirty dishes. "Here we go again. I can never count on you." We even get messages from items we use on a daily basis. Imagine what your TV might be saying to you. You have a bunch of recordings that you haven't watched yet. Oh, and maybe it's about time you gave me a light dusting. And your laptop. It sure would be nice to have a printer as a friend. Oh, well, never mind. And there's the body soap in the bathroom. "Excuse me, I'm running out." As to the bed sheets, "I know you're busy, but would you mind giving me a wash one of these days soon?" All of our possessions want to be cared for, and they tell us that every time we look at them. They begin to form lines in our head, waiting their turn for us to really look at them and listen to what they have to say. This line of things gets longer and longer as we acquire more material possessions. I call that list the silent to-do list. Of course, our possessions aren't going to literally tell us to do this and that. Unlike our real-life to-do lists, there aren't any bosses or clients to harass us until we get it done. But when left unattended, it'll grow into a huge to-do list. It's only natural that when a person, a piece of 50,000-year-old hardware, is told to do too many things at once, they're going to lock up and freeze. I suspect that when we're feeling lazy or unmotivated, it's either because our to-do list is too long, or we're surrounded by so many menial tasks that we can't get around to doing what's important. Giving our important things the space to be important. People often say that a person who has a messy desk isn't very productive, and I think the silent to-do list is the reason why. When a desk is cluttered with unorganized business cards, papers that need to be filed, and reference materials that need to be thrown away, it's essentially a huge silent to-do list pile that saps our concentration. It'll take forever to find things in that pile, and while we're searching through the clutter for the real to-do list that we need to focus on, we lose track of our priorities. At that point, the pile becomes overwhelming, our self-respect plummets, the stress builds up, and we escape to our smartphone or go on the internet and check out some social media. We're trapped in a vicious circle. When we have fewer possessions, these silent messages will, quite naturally, become fewer as well. Without the pile, there's less effort required to prioritize these messages. And if we do receive a message or two, we have the capacity to respond right away. This is why it's easier to concentrate when we have fewer material possessions. And with all those excess silent to-do messages gone, we can focus on the truly important things that remain. Lionel Messi's minimalism. The only way to focus on the important things is to reduce the things that aren't important. As I mentioned in Chapter 1, this is the guiding principle of minimalism. I think the soccer star Lionel Messi is one example of someone who fully grasps this principle. Messi, who plays for FC Barcelona and will probably go down in history as one of the sport's best players, is known for running short distances in his matches. While professional soccer players in general run about 10 kilometers per match on average, Messi's average is 8 kilometers. In fact, you often see him walking on the field during a match. There's also data that indicate that he not only jogs instead of running to get back into a defensive position, he doesn't often make an all-out effort to run on offense either. I think Messi's minimalist style is why he is the top player in the world. He has a clear picture of the crucial moments when he needs to go full force to surpass his opponents. To him, scoring is his top priority. He's reduced everything else to save his energy and focus on what's truly important, those crucial opportunities to score. Steve Jobs, the perfect minimalist. Steve Jobs was not a minimalist simply because he always wore the same thing and removed excess from his products. Minimalism really did guide almost everything he did. The first thing that Jobs is said to have done after making his comeback to Apple was to donate old documents and machines that were almost covered by cobwebs to a museum. He started out by parting with material objects. He wanted to focus on producing products that would change the world, so he got rid of everything else that wasn't important. He reduced the number of people who took part in company meetings. He would see someone who he didn't think was needed for a meeting and say to them without hesitation, "Thanks, but you don't have to take part in this meeting." He liked to make decisions with the minimum number of talented people. I've heard that Apple respected ideas more than it did processes, which follows the same principle. In many companies, a designer could come up with a fantastic concept, but it would eventually be watered down as it went through marketing, advertising, sales, and so on. Jobs despised such processes and did away with them. He believed that the more signatures you need to approve a product, the more boring the idea is going to become, and the more time it's going to take for it to become a finished product. In almost everything he did, Jobs started not by prioritizing what he would do, but rather by focusing first on what not to do. In that sense, he really was the perfect minimalist. He dedicated himself to getting rid of things. The happiness of flow. Psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi studied a state of happiness triggered by concentration that he called flow. When people are completely involved in something, they're not only able to forget their problems, they actually lose track of the passing of time. With further concentration, even the notion of ego or self can disappear. They begin to feel a sense of contentment and the joy of living. The key to flow is the sense of contentment with the passing of time. The consumption of an engrossing movie or TV series may mask the passing of time, but it doesn't lead to a state of flow. Csikszentmihalyi's example is the performance of music. But really, if you've ever been so immersed in doing something complicated that you've forgotten everything else, you've probably been in a state of flow. Flow isn't something that everyone can discover, but you'll know with certainty when you find it because you'll be able to immerse yourself into a deeper state of concentration than you've experienced before. That level of concentration is rarely possible until we've reduced all distractions and unnecessary things. Once we have, we open up the possibility of flow, and we can go on to find more happiness. Information minimalism. Human beings are 50,000-year-old pieces of hardware. Neither our brains nor our bodies have significantly evolved since 50,000 years ago. Even though recent generations have grown up with digital technology and web connectivity, it doesn't mean our brains suddenly have more storage space or better memory. If we overload our brains, we'll freeze up just like old computers. Reduce your possessions and you'll receive fewer messages from them. Less memory will be required for dealing with those items, and your brain will be able to function more comfortably. The same thing can be said for information. In this section, I'd like to talk about reducing the amount of information that we obtain, what I call information minimalism. Folding up your antenna. You may have heard the term junk information before. We might see something on the web that seems to grab our attention at first, only to later realize that there hadn't been much meaning to it, if we haven't already forgotten about it, that is. Consuming too much junk information will lead to a state of information metabolic syndrome. Tests have shown that people flooded with excess amounts of information perform worse on brain tests than when they smoked marijuana. The issue now is not how much of that excess information we can obtain, but instead how we can distance ourselves from those flows and decrease the amount of useless information that we take in. The amount of information available today continues to grow at an explosive rate. If you own a smartphone, then you've probably checked your email before even realizing it, and then found yourself clicking on various links or maybe playing games for hours on end. Rather than broadening the reach of your antenna, the more important thing to do is to fold it up and decrease the amount of information that you absorb. One key way to fold up your antenna is to just reduce the opportunities you have to access information. We often hear about exhaustion from excessive dependence on social media or stress from always being connected with others. Tomohiko Yoneda's Digital Detox no Susume, Digital Detox Recommendations, offers interesting examples of ways to disconnect. There's a hotel with a digital detox plan where you hand over your smartphone and laptop at check-in. There are smartphone-free bars where you can just focus on having conversations with people over drinks. Volkswagen has banned email communication among employees late at night and early in the morning. And Daimler has introduced a system where emails sent to employees during their vacations are automatically deleted. These companies are trying to reduce information overload for the sake of people's personal lives. Meditation, Zen, and Yoga. Many minimalists meditate and practice Zen or yoga, which is quite natural when you think about it. When you decrease the number of material possessions that you have, you become less distracted by your surroundings, and your awareness naturally shifts inward. I used to have a bias against meditation. It had this New Age sketchy feel. But one day, I had the opportunity to take part in a Zen session with the monk Ryonosuke Koike. It was amazing. Meditation became a habit. Various thoughts go through your mind when you meditate. You focus on those thoughts and concentrate on simply breathing. Your power of concentration starts to improve, making it second nature, even when you aren't meditating. You learn to grasp and direct your train of thought. For me, Zen and meditation have improved my state of mind so much, it's as if I were reinstalling my personal operating system. Google and Facebook are also pretty heavily into Zen and meditation. Google holds meditation workshops, and I hear they even created labyrinths for walking meditation in their offices. It's easy to drown in the flood of information around us. Making a little time for inner reflection like meditation, Zen, and yoga can help a lot. Using minimalism to concentrate on being yourself. Since I became a minimalist, I think the haze that had always enveloped my muddled senses has been slowly clearing up. I was like an unfocused college student. I would read and watch all sorts of things, as long as they had already received high acclaim. I was studying great people and great works, but I wasn't really making my own choices. I was just consuming information haphazardly. All that, I think, has started to change. Having minimized my material possessions, I've also started to minimize the information I take in. I no longer follow useless news, gossip, or random stand-up comedy. I don't try to fill my conversations with things that other people have made or done. Instead of focusing on the voices of others, I focus on and believe in the voice that's coming from me. What I often feel now is that I'm returning to myself. I used to feel that so many great things had already been produced in the world that there was nothing I could add. I was so worried about what other people would think that I developed an oversized fear of making mistakes. If I came up with a great idea, I'd reject it because it came from me. This is what I imagine. There used to be another me who lived inside me. He had the same size, shape, and form as my usual self. But the more concerned I became about the outside world, the smaller the inside me got. He was so battered that he could barely get back on his feet. But I now feel as though that little old me has finally gotten up. Minimalism has given me the focus to revive my inner me. I save money, and I care more about the environment.
To be smart enough to get all that money, you must be dull enough to want it.
Gilbert Keith Chesterton. Minimalism's minimal costs. Minimalism is a very effective way to cut down on costs. We save money in various ways when we become minimalists, and in some cases, we may even gain money. 1. Fewer material possessions means we don't need a big house to live in, which means a lot less spent on housing. 2. Selling everything we've collected to date will bring in some money. 3. We're more selective when we buy something, which means less money wasted on frivolous purchases. 4. We're satisfied with the things that we already have, which will lead to less desire for other possessions going forward. 5. Minimalism reduces stress, which helps us eliminate the food and drink costs that had previously existed just for stress relief. 6. We won't be as worried about how others see us as we were before. As a result, we won't need to spend more than what's truly necessary for weddings, childcare, funerals, and other events. 7. Using minimalism at work will likely lead to more efficiency and a higher income. Will minimalism lead to a collapse of the economy? Some people might worry about the potential risks to the economy if more and more people turn to minimalism. But minimalism isn't quite that simple. There are, of course, minimalists who don't care about possessions, but there are also those who love material objects. Take a dinner plate, for example. The focus for one person might be cost-effectiveness. They may be perfectly happy with dinnerware from a dollar store, while the next person might want to use an exquisite item created by a master craftsman. I'm one of those minimalists who love things. I take one look at a magazine, and I still enjoy seeing all the things that I'd like to get. The only thing that's changed is that I no longer buy things just because I want them. I've certainly become more careful about how I spend my money. But I do still spend money in the end. For example, I've started spending money more on experiences and people than on material objects. I'd like to travel and spend more time in contact with nature. I spend money on transportation to see the people who I want to see. I help crowdfund projects that I think are interesting. If I see people looking for new ways to live, I'll contribute to them directly. Minimalism is very effective for cutting down on costs, but it isn't limited to just that. We can change the way we use money. We can direct it away from things that are just for show and invest instead in experiences, people, or new initiatives. We can spend our money where it's really important. Minimizing our waste. After discarding a lot of my possessions, I found myself wanting to minimize the amount of waste I create going forward. I used to have doubts about LOHAS, lifestyles of health and sustainability, and eco-activities, but minimalism has changed my outlook. I always used to buy 2-liter bottles of water, but with this niggling sense of wastefulness, I switched to using a Brita water filtration system. I've tried using a solar lantern at night that can be charged in the sun during the day. Living with fewer possessions, I have little in the way of electric appliances, and my electricity bills have gone down. Now I want to keep my gas and water bills minimal as well. When you live a life surrounded only by the things that are really necessary, you tend to develop a desire to reduce everything else that isn't essential as well, like garbage and energy, and live simply in a compact way. The resources that we have will eventually be depleted. Discussions about the Earth's resources generally mention another century or so of productive mining years. We won't be around 3 or 4 generations from now, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't worry about the future. I've heard about a Native American teaching that says when something needs to be decided, they look 7 generations ahead, which seems to make much more sense. When you become a minimalist, the energy you use will also become minimal. You won't need to try to live in an eco-friendly way. It'll come naturally. By minimizing your possessions and settling into a focused, simple life, you'll find that the weight on your shoulders has become lighter and you're living in a way that's gentler on the environment. And you know what? It gives you a pretty good feeling. I'm healthier and safer.
A table, a chair, a bowl of fruit and a violin. What else does a man need to be happy?
Albert Einstein. Minimalists are slim. I've met a lot of minimalists, but none of them, at least so far, have been overweight. I wonder why. I've read in a lot of books on decluttering that weight loss is an added bonus that results from discarding your extra things. Since I became a minimalist, I've lost about 10 kilos, about 22 pounds, myself. Many others have described this effect by observing that when the things that have been stuck around you begin to move, your chi, the life force that flows through everything, will flow better and you will also slim down. I think there are other, more specific things happening as well. I think there are several reasons why you might lose weight when you part with your possessions. We often gain weight because we're eating more than our bodies need. Maybe we're eating too much because it relieves stress. We can forget about our problems while we're eating. The same can certainly be said for drinking. When you say goodbye to your things, you'll have less stress because there aren't all those things around that soak up your energy. By not comparing yourself with others, you'll relieve even more stress.